Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
If there's a global center of spycraft, it's probably New York City. More than Washington, D.C., more than London, more than Vienna. New York, especially Manhattan, offers all sorts of factors that make it great for spying. The presence of the United Nations, plenty of diplomats, plenty of state intelligence. There's a diverse ethnic makeup, so it's easy to blend into the city no matter where you're from or what your accent is. And it's also an international financial and cultural center. The sheer number of countries represented at the UN, and with all the consulates combined with the science, technology, and financial power of private interests throughout New York, makes it an irresistible playground for spies. Today, my guests are Keith Melton and Robert Wallace, authors of the new book, Spy Sites of New York City, A Guide to the Region's Secret History. Keith Melton was the espionage advisor on the show The Americans on FX, and Robert Wallace is the former chief of the CIA's Office of Technical Service. In this episode, we're going to look at New York and how it's always been a hotbed of spycraft. Going from George Washington's downtown spy ring, the Culper spy ring, that offered critical intelligence on British troop movements that allowed America to win the Revolutionary War, up to the Cold War when Alger Hiss met his handler at a Park Slope movie theater, and many other people that I had no idea about, like Valvoline Dickinson, who during the Great Depression, her and her husband moved from San Francisco to New York and opened a doll shop and provided intelligence to Japan during World War II. So in this episode, we talk about these spy stories, what most people misunderstand about spies and their work, and how spycraft is changing as things go digital, and whether future spy history books will have URLs instead of street addresses. So there's a lot to uncover here. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Keith Melton and Robert Wallace. Bob and Keith, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Well, I am very intrigued by this topic, and I've done a number of episodes in the past on spycraft from ancient Greece up through revolutionary America, the Cold War, and today, and the two of you have as well. And before we get into this, I'm curious, why did you focus on New York City as your point of focus? Because I've heard that other cities were preeminent in spycraft. I've heard Vienna, Austria come up a lot in the Cold War. So what about New York stands out to you?
Well, as Bob and I looked at the cities in the United States that would make sense to chronicle the espionage activities, the top two were New York City and Washington. And we've completed a very successful book on Washington, D.C. that was fortunately a bestseller. And second only to New York, to Washington, and perhaps even more important in Washington is New York City. And it has been probably the greatest concentration of spies, perhaps in the United States. I couldn't arguably say maybe, I don't know how it would rank in Vienna, but with the presence of the United Nations and with the welcome attitude we have to countries that were otherwise be considered adversaries, it is a density of people that allows espionage to successfully take place kind of under the covers and beneath the public gaze. So there's a great deal of clandestine activity always underway in the Big Apple.
Once the Revolutionary War looked like it was going to happen, there were really two focal points of espionage spying activity in the United States. One was Philadelphia and the other was New York, given the leadership that George Washington was providing to the Revolutionary Army at the time and his positioning. New York became the initial point of the Revolutionary War for the major espionage activities. So that is, in a sense, a beginning of New York's prominence in the world of espionage. And today, with the United Nations and the commercial, as power of New York, the worldwide commercial power of New York, it is arguably spy central for the world.
Yeah, I'd like to back up and then talk about New York's early days as a center of spycraft. I did a series with a co-host on the Revolutionary War, and we spent an entire episode talking about espionage and the Culper spy ring, other groups like that. But I would love to hear the two of you discuss what this looks like in the Revolutionary War. And also, what does spycraft mean at this time in the 1700s? Because I don't think a lot of people have a concept of that. And there's much that's different, of course. A lot of spying and espionage has to do with the digital era. But then there's also things that they did back then that I think would have a lot of resemblance to today of how do you set up intelligence networks? How do you set up informants? How do you observe troop movements and stuff? So what did spycraft look like in the Revolutionary War? And what about it was unique to New York at that time?
Well, Scott, one thing is that as Bob and I have looked back, the goals of espionage have really never changed throughout history. You're simply trying to gain information about an adversary, and hopefully you can gain it without the adversary knowing that it's lost. It gives your military and political leaders an advantage to keep the country safe. In time of war, you're trying to course press a military advantage. And in the Revolutionary War, the objectives were, we were fighting an asymmetrical war. The colonials were vastly outpowered, outsourced, outresourced, outgunned, outmanned by the British Empire. And espionage was a leveling factor that enabled the fighting colonials to level the playing field and gain some advantage. And the basic tenets of identifying information that you need, tasking agents to get it, finding ways that they can communicate secretly using, instead of secret inks, they call them sympathetic stains, but trying to maintain the security of a cell, a group of people, finding ways to clandestinely use dead drops to pass messages, how to avoid counterintelligence, what do you do if you have infiltrators? All of these things continue to be issues today. The determining and perhaps delineating factor is the technology that was involved. So though the goals of spies don't change, the technology they use to accomplish those goals is constantly evolving. And we see the rudimentary work that was done in the Rev War was so highly successful that it was sometimes 100, 150 years later before individual agents were finally named through analysis of handwriting that was done, 100 years later. So they did the Washington Ring, the Culper Ring, they did their job very well and used the technology available to them. Now, that same techniques would not have been successful today because we have far more technology. But at the time, they were very skilled and accomplished with what they did.
This intersection of espionage operations and technology is going to be a theme throughout the book. And I would characterize the relationship as one in which you can be assured that spy agencies in every era will make use of every available technology to accomplish their mission. So to compare today with the Revolutionary War, I think at one level is simply to reinforce that what the folks at the time of the Revolutionary War had, the technologies, chemistry technologies, some of the technologies they could use for to cover their operations. They used what was available. And today, the digital world, spies use what's available today. One of the pieces of technology I thought was particularly fascinating on the New York side was the story of the turtle. which is arguably, America's first underwater attack submarine. And this was developed by an inventor by the name of David Bushnell, with the objective of implanting an explosive device on the British warship, the Eagle, the HMS Eagle. And this underwater device, operated just below the surface of the water, could be powered by a propeller driven by a bicycle guy in the turtle, pedaling and driving out to the warship and attempting to attach the device. Now, for a variety of technical reasons, the device wasn't attached, but it was an indication early of America's innovative way to use technology to accomplish spying operations.
And this was in the Revolutionary War era when the turtle was designed?
Yes, it was Revolutionary. The attack was attempted in 1776, in September of 1776. The primary reason that the attack failed was that the warship had a metal copper hull, and the people were expecting a wooden hull, and so the explosive device couldn't be attached.
And before we jump ahead a little bit, I'd love to give some time to Robert Townsend, which you had mentioned, somebody that was unknown to us for 150 years because his identity remained secret. How did he gather intelligence during the Revolutionary War? What were the mechanics that he would learn something? And then what was the step-by-step process that his information would be passed from hand to hand to hand until it would reach General Washington?
Townsend had a store near the harbor. It was known as Peck Slip. And this store was frequented by the British occupiers, British troops that were occupying the city. So as a result of his store ownership and both his observation of the British as well as his discussions with the British, conversations with the British, he was able to collect information that then was passed back to Washington through the Culper ring that you described previously.
The Scott, his ring was operating out of Peck Slip near Pearl Street. It's been redeveloped today, but from there, and with his college classmates and a drinking partner, They essentially began to father this idea to gather information and somehow get it to Washington. And they established aliases as well as code numbers for secrecy and communication. Washington's number, for example, was 711, while Talmadge was 721. One interesting one has always been the mystery of who was Agent 355, a female member of the ring that was perhaps never finally identified, other various accounts, but she served so successfully that she still serves in silence. And there was an account that she was arrested and imprisoned on the HMS Jersey and gave birth to a child, but even then managed to keep secrets, the Culper's ring secrets, even as she was dying. Another account holds that she was a member of a coterie of a Major John Andre. So it's still mystery around who was 355, and could it have been the elusive Anna Strong, one of the Setauket members of the Culper ring? So there are still embedded mysteries that even so long after, their ability to operate clandestinely is still holding.
One of the footnotes to the Townsend story is that Townsend wanted to actively join the Washington forces, and Washington wrote him back and said, no, I don't want you with my unit or for you to join the Revolutionary Force. You are more valuable in the role that you're playing as being a source of information for me.
And I don't know if the two of you have seen this. There's a drama series that was on AMC, I think, called Turn, that all these events you're talking about with the Culper spy ring and these different characters, and even the submersible turtle makes an appearance in the show. Have either of you two seen that?
I have seen a number of seasons of it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. There is a great deal of liberty taken with some of the technology that they show being employed, because some of it wasn't even invented until years after the Rev War. But the way in which they're using agents, I believe, is far truer to the historical narrative, and the agent handling, agent recruitment, trying to maintain the secrecy of the cells, I think that's quite good. And it tells a very enjoyable story.
Right. And the series is on Netflix. So listeners, if this intrigues you, I recommend you check it out about into season 3 out of 4. But I want to jump ahead a few decades and other people that you look into and their biographies as spies. One of which I'd never heard of before and I'm very intrigued by is Valvoly Dickinson, the doll-making spy. And I had never thought of spying on behalf of Imperial Japan in World War II, but there's no reason we wouldn't have that. So what's her story?
This lady was a spy for the Japanese, and she and her husband had gotten immersed in the Japanese community while they were living on the West Coast. And sometime in the late 1930s, they moved to New York. And from New York, they would make frequent trips back to the West Coast. This pattern was somewhat unusual because their business, that is the doll making business, wasn't seen as particularly profitable, but they had money to constantly make these trips. What eventually it was discovered, in part through the work of the letter opening operation run by the British out of Bermuda, this lady was going to the West Coast and observing U.S. shipping, military as well as commercial operations out of the West Coast, and then reporting that through letters that ostensibly were giving details of doll sales. So this was an open code that she was using to communicate with her handlers what she was observing during these West Coast trips.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. How valuable was the intelligence that they gave, and were they ever captured during the war?
Yes. She, in fact, was discovered during the war. The value of the information, I can't make a definitive judgment on it. In many cases, intelligence operations are designed to acquire bits and pieces of information. Standing alone, they may not seem like of great significance, but then when put together by a strong analytical component, can in fact form, if you will, a mosaic. You know, each little piece of information represents a small rock, but if you put all of the rocks together in a pattern, why, you get the full picture. This is probably what Dickinson was doing in her collection.
And one of the things, the site of her doll shop at 718 Madison Street is still in place. It's now owned by Beretta Arms, which kind of an interesting use of the property. But it was, for us, it's fascinating where buildings are still in place. And we've tried to, throughout the book, call out where the original premises still stands. As if buildings could talk, it could certainly tell stories.
Scott, you mentioned Miss Dickens. I think this is a point that was fascinating to me as we were doing the whole book, and that is the prominence of women in the spying operations going into at every era that we talk about in the book. There are significant women spies who perform espionage with both daring and courage. And I guess the numbers of women that appear in our book is particularly striking to me, and the fact that, you know, regardless of the cultural norms of the time, intelligence agencies find use for anyone who has the access and the capability to serve in that kind of a capacity.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because that was something that my co-host and I discussed when we were mentioning the Culper spy ring in the Revolutionary War and Anna Strong, whom you mentioned, that it wasn't just Anna Strong. I think there was also a female slave who was part of the Culper spy ring. And these figures, they're connected to powerful people, but they're overlooked or just not noticed. And people who are talking about active intelligence think, well, okay, she's a barmaid or she owns a tavern. She couldn't do anything with this information, so I'm going to be less guarded. And because they're taken for granted, these females in important places, they can have incredible intelligence they gather. And because of this, their ability to access these different situations is what can make them such valuable assets. That's sort of what we came across. So how do you see that?
Well, I would offer that not only was that true then, but it has been true up until recent times. If you go and if you look during the height of the Cold War, Russian intelligence officers routinely dismissed the ability of women to serve as case officers. And the first female case officer we had in Moscow, Marty Peters, who ran Trigon, was very effective at first because no one thought to put her under surveillance, because someone that important, a job that important, wouldn't have been given to a woman. And certain cultures tend to dismiss women's capabilities. And I think you could see vestiges of it certainly starting back in the American Revolution and continuing at least until the 1990s. And I would say that there's still perhaps some bias in certain services even today.
I would observe that maybe at the time in the 1700s, 1800s, women were perhaps not as a group as willing to brag about their spy exploits as men were. And an exception to that was Pauline Cushman during the Civil War, who was a spy for the Union Army, a very successful one. She was also something of an actress, and they became a public figure. And she defies my stereotype of saying that women were less willing to describe their exploits, because she wrote a biography, or contributed to a biography, that has probably the longest title of any spy book in history. It's called Life of Pauline Cushman, the Celebrated Union Spy and Scout, comprising her early history, her entry into the Secret Service of the Army of the Cumberland, and exciting adventures with the rebel chieftains and others while within the enemy lines, together with her capture and sentence to death by General Bragg, and final rescue by the Union Army under General Rosecrans. Now, there you go.
I love the old books. You don't need an explanation on the back of what it's about, because it's all right there in the title. It'll just give it away.
In this case, she did.
Okay, I didn't know her story either. What did she accomplish in the Civil War?
Well, her primary role was she was posed as one of these camp followers. And during the Civil War, the lines were very fluid, and particularly for people who just kind of wanted to wander in and out of the various locations or encampments. If you were selling things, selling certain supplies, or you had other kind of similarly legitimate reason to be in the area, you could kind of just wander through the encampments and thereby collect quite a bit of information in terms of where, what the locations were, what the plans for movement were, and that sort of thing. Remember, in the Civil War era, I have a difficult time sometimes putting myself back into that time, but there was no such thing as overhead reconnaissance, and there was very little rapid communication. So knowing where the other armies were at bivouac, or where their camps might have been, was always a challenge for the generals on both sides of the war. Cushman was one of the people who dressed as a man and was able to infiltrate into the Confederate camps.
And Bob, and she also was very effective as posing as a Confederate camp follower, which
yes,
we don't think about much these days, where we have centralized logistics that do a good job of supporting our troops. But during the Civil War, literally there was a legion of camp followers, being cooks and people who do laundry, spouses, prostitutes, that would literally follow the soldiers and help them make camp. Well, in this unofficial army of followers was fertile opportunity to gather espionage, and she fit in very nicely and was able to provide up-to-date battlefield intelligence that then could be used effectively. So once again, a woman effectively used her skills, but she also donned a Union soldier's uniform when she recounted her exploits. So being an actress certainly enabled her to be more effective in both roles.
Well, to springboard off our discussion of women as an underestimated group that were able to accomplish a lot, I'd like to focus on another underestimated group that did a lot, and that is Iowans. And as someone from the home, my home state being Iowa, always interested in the story of George Koval, who could be looked at as a bumpkin farm boy from Sioux City, and I would argue maybe the most effective nuclear spy who ever lived. So tell us his story, and then also how he was finally found out decades and decades and decades after he did his spycraft.
We later learned that Koval's code name was Delmar. And, of course, he had been born in Sioux City in 1913, very bright, went to the Mendeleev Institute of Chemical Technology in Moscow, was recruited there by Soviet military intelligence, spoke unaccented American English. He understood the culture. He played baseball. Played it well, someone said. He left his wife in the USSR and returned to the U.S. around 1940, lived in the Bronx, attended classes at Columbia University, but his primary job was as the deputy resident of the secret GRU station. Now, GRU, as many of your listeners will know, is Soviet military intelligence at the time, and they operated somewhat in parallel with the NKVD, which was the predecessor of the KGB. And the GRU played a dominant role in work on the atomic bomb. And so he operated undercover at a company called Raven Electric Company at 889 Broadway. And he was the deputy resident, and they not only provided him with cover, but also helped him with a deferment that protected him from the military draft until 1943. And once he was in the Army, had an exceptionally high IQ, which eventually he was drawn into the top secret Manhattan Project, which gave him even more access to information. So he was very, very bright. At the end of the war, he continued his education at the City College of New York, finally came under scrutiny in 1948 after U.S. counterintelligence agents discovered a story about the Koval family and a Soviet publication. He eventually fled the country. In 2002, a book appeared in Russia called The GRU and the Atomic Bomb, which referenced a spy known only by a codename, Delmar. It was only in 2007 that Vladimir Putin posthumously recognized Koval as a hero of the Russian Federation and revealed that he was the infamous and unknown Delmar. So it had he maintained his silence and secrecy to the grave.
And I think he worked on the Manhattan Project, or he was at least in the periphery of that and bumped up the Soviet nuclear program by a few years. Do I have that right?
He certainly was involved in it. I have not seen the fact that he sped them ahead 2 years, but they were so effectively collecting on the Manhattan Project. One of the interesting things in counterintelligence you talk about is, well, the FBI talks about, is how effectively they stopped the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese from penetrating our key military defense programs, and certainly the Manhattan Project. And there was no hostile Axis penetration. The problem was we were thoroughly penetrated by our friends, and Russia at the time was a friend, and they thoroughly penetrated it. And where we anticipated ending the Cold War with at least a decade of advantage, in which we would have had unilateral control of the atomic bomb, that certainly eroded very quickly. And within 4 years, Russia had tested an effective atomic weapon. So they operated very effectively and has to go down as one of the most effective espionage operations in our history, that they were able to penetrate Manhattan Project so effectively and pull from it the key bits of data, especially on the implosion technique being the most successful way to detonate the device. So Koval played an important role and managed to avoid scrutiny for so many years. So it was a very effective operation.
And if I just may add on that point, it picks up on a statement I made earlier that the business of intelligence collection requires multiple sources with multiple access if you're going to get a full picture. So the beauty from the standpoint of just looking at an espionage operation of what the Soviets did on the Manhattan Project is they didn't just concentrate on Columbia and in New York. They were at Los Alamos. They were at Oak Ridge. They were in Chicago. Any place where the Manhattan Project had some kind of activity, the Soviets seemed to have been able to find or deploy agents to pick the information out of that particular location, and then they effectively put it together.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character, and I read somewhere about Koval that after he defected to the USSR, he taught at a university, but there were still parts of his American life that stayed with him to the end, where he would teach about nuclear physics, but then mispronounce words like thermocoupler in an English accent instead of a Russian, and students would snicker at him. But getting into the Cold War, there's one other character I'm very interested in about, is a congressman who was actively involved in the House Un-American Activities Committee, who himself was a spy. So how does this all come about, the story of Samuel Dixon?
Well, Samuel Dixon is one of our favorites. His NKVD assigned codename Crook should tell you all you need to know about what they thought of him as well. And he was a New York congressman and was actively involved in providing information. He was always wanting more money for the Soviets, and they thought that was an effective title for him. In the book, we were surprised to find how many roads in a little square in Washington, in New York City, are still named in his honor, as if he has any honor left. But it's amazing that we had congressmen that were operating as active Soviet agents.
I think it is not surprising, though, that the Soviets early on would focus on Congress and that part of the United States government as possible places for penetration. Likely that has become even more the case in recent years as the whole process of congressional oversight has enabled congressional staff and congressional members to have greater and greater insight into specific intelligence operations. That is not a statement to be critical of the oversight process. It's a statement just to emphasize that when intelligence operations look at potential, where potential sources might be, the first question they ask is, what is the access? And if someone or some people in an institution have access to the classified, to the sensitive information, they are going to go after it. If I may just step back, though, to the start of the Congressman Dickstein's spying, the House Committee on Un-American Activities was initially set up to go after Nazis, and that was the focus on the original discussions and the original formation of the committee that goes back to 1934. And it was only subsequently, primarily in the 1940s, that the committee changed its focus more to the Soviet and to the communist threat.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. That leads into another issue, and I want to take a step back and look more generally at spycraft and discuss what do most people misunderstand about spies and their work. For example, with Samuel Dixon, I don't know if he was recruited by the Soviets while he was a politician, or some might guess he was a Manchurian candidate that was groomed for this type of thing. I think when people see spycraft in fiction like James Bond, most people know that that's a ridiculous exaggeration and there's very little that's realistic about him. But now it seems like when people talk about spycraft, everyone is assuming a Manchurian candidate that, oh, Russia in 2016 and 2020, they had sleeper cells. They have politicians they've groomed for decades to destabilize our democracy. So it's almost taken for granted that there's Manchurian candidates everywhere. Is a Manchurian candidate something that's realistic? And what are other things that people misunderstand about spies and their work?
I'll take a first stab at it. I believe the Samuel Condon novel, that the Manchurian candidate, was a sensation at the time, and it came after at a point in the 1950s that we believed it was possible, the Soviets believed, and the U.S. believed it was possible to create pharmacological spies. It turned out to not be dependable, not be accurate, but it certainly spawned popular opinion that that was true. That led to U.S. operations in MK Ultra, where we attempted to create many of those same programs, but you know, mostly ineffective. However, it if you're going to be a spy, you clearly have to have defined objectives, and those objectives have to be there for a purpose and a reason. You need to provide them back. In the case of Congressman Dickstein, he was making $1,250 a month extra income, which was a significant sum at the time, and providing information to his handlers on fascist German agents, white Russians. He was in a position to pass along very, very important information. So it continues to be successful. He was an unusual point. What's kind of strange is that he was later a New York Supreme Court judge, but it was only until the 1990s that information on his true political leanings and the betrayal of the country came out. So it was interesting that history kept it hidden so long.
I think that one of the important misunderstandings of spies is the failure to make the distinction between an intelligence officer and a spy. In my career at the CIA, I was an intelligence officer. I was not a spy. Someone like Robert Hansen, or from the FBI, an FBI special agent, or Aldrich Ames, a CIA officer, they were both intelligence officers working for their country, working for the United States, and they were spies, that is, providing clandestine reporting to their spy handlers. To their, if you will, intelligence officers who happened to be Soviets, who were Soviets. So in most cases, when we talk about an individual, it's useful to make that distinction as to whether the individual is an officer, an intelligence officer handling spies, or the individual is the spy who has the direct access to the sensitive classified information and is providing that unauthorized to the foreign power. I think that is a distinction that would clarify a lot of misunderstandings if made more carefully.
Right. That is a very good point to make, too, since these can all get mixed together. Earlier in the episode, you had mentioned that there are factors of spycraft that are consistent across history. If we're talking the era of Sun Tzu 2,000 years ago versus today. In terms of motivations of those who become spies, do you see that they largely have the same motivations they did in the past, whether money, power, sex, whatever? Or do you see ways that the motives or psychology has changed over the years?
I would offer to you the popular acronym where we list four motivations: money, ideology, compromise or blackmail, and ego. And you can always think of these under the acronym MICE, M-I-C-E. If you add to those failed marriages, failed careers, jealous coworkers, substance abuse, family problems, and as one of our friends, Dr. David Charney, who's a psychiatrist known as the kind of the psychiatrist of the spies, since he tends to work with many of them after they've caught. He has a theory that says a person becomes a spy when they wake up in the morning and the person they look at in the mirror is an abject failure in life and is so disillusioned. If they have access to secrets and they can convert that to some monetary gain, it is a temporary feel-good that offsets the ongoing pain they're living in their life. They are, however, unrealizing that ultimately the cumulative effect of betraying your country will bring far greater problems than ever before. And so people that betray their country, the great lesson we learned in the Cold War was that loyal Americans would betray their country for money. And this is something we had never really thought of during, for example, World War II. But in the Cold War, it became clear that the majority of the spies that did the greatest damage did it for financial gain. If you look at the, the Aldrich Ames, you look at the Robert Hansons, you look at the other significant John Walker, they're selling out the country for money. That tends to still be probably the primary problem that we have. Even under subtleties where a foreign intelligence service can step in and buy the technology or try to buy the company that's producing the technology under the guise that you simply acquire it and you're from a quasi-friendly country and you want to just buy the whole company itself. So money tends to be a very, very important lure, and just some people are more vulnerable than others. What the internet has done, because of the availability of information on everybody, makes it easier for a foreign intelligence service to identify individuals who have outstanding debts and financial problems and perhaps other problems that may leave them open to recruitment. So the internet has in many ways made the art of recruitment more effective these days. Bob, I know Bob has thoughts on this as well.
I would like to add to the family, to the nest of mice, some rats. And I think we have seen, particularly in maybe the last 30 years, the evolution of some of these other motivations, and I use the acronym RATS to stand for revenge, affinity, theology, and security. And we've seen a significant number of cases where people have become spies or turned to spying as a revenge against either the institution or individuals that they perceive have mistreated them. We also see significant affinity. That is, people who get into the spy business because of family relationships. The John Walker case is one. Actually, the Culper spy ring going back is another where the relationships were very significant. The Rosenbergs were became a family spy operation motivated partially by affinity, I would argue. Then the theology factor has been significant in what we have seen as in terms of the recruitment, particularly for some of the radical terrorist kinds of operations. They appeal to the theology involved. And finally, there are spies that are interested in security, either for themselves or their family. These are most often folks, individuals who come from places where either political or physical security is always an issue, is not assured. And so when an intelligence organization can offer a sense of security for the individual or for their families, that becomes a very attractive motivator.
That's very interesting when you mention some of the reasons and that a person who sees himself as a failure would want to become a spy. That profile matches up closely to would-be political assassins, people who are failed upstarts in life and want to make a name for themselves. And they figure the fastest way to do that is to try to kill a senator or president, at least from profiles I've read of would-be assassins. They sound very similar to what you described as a potential spy. So to, I think, wrap up a lot of these things, I have a two-parter final question. In light of the not-so-glamorous profile of these spies that you mentioned, what is it about spy stories that continue to capture our imagination, and will spycraft remain how it has been, or do you think it's going to change in the digital era?
Well, I'll take the first stab at it. Spies have been a part of our history since recorded time. every government throughout history has had some intelligence component which enabled to give their military and political leaders information that could help keep the country safe. It's 132 references in the New Testament to espionage and spies. So it's part of our culture and our history. I believe it will continue to be, and perhaps the stakes will raise even more. It's the public fascination with it that I believe became prominent after wars. After the Rev War, there were a number of writings of individuals that gave their exploits. After the Civil War, Pauline Cushman and others gave somewhat embellished stories over their successes and the daring adventures they were in. But when we get into World War II and the Cold War, we find far more accurate, detailed recountings of operations and motivations and the importance. And we see that the work, for example, on the Enigma, and stealing the Enigma secrets, shortened the war arguably as much, World War II, as much as 2 years. You can talk about spies, individual spies in the early 60s during the standoff between Russia and China and the Cuba crisis. The role of Oleg Penkovsky, arguably the man who saved the world from a nuclear war at that point. It's far easier to pinpoint specific actions and correlate them with success and how they've changed history. So it's now inculcated into our society so much that if anything, we think everyone's a spy. But you counterbalance that with the fact that as we now welcome into our country immigrants from many countries that have historically been adversarial, there are millions of Russians living in the U.S. We welcome millions of Chinese into the country, where we know that China is the number one strategic threat, espionage-wise, to the United States, and Russia is certainly the number one technical threat to the U.S. We're welcoming individuals, most of whom come here peacefully and want to become citizens, but a large number are operating undercover. And of course, that was the premise of the highly successful series on FX, The Americans, which was based on the real case of ghost stories, which of course, great portions of it happened significantly in New York City with Anna Chopman and her cohorts. So it's going to continue.
Scott, I would add that whether a spy is seen as an attractive personality or character frequently depends on whether that person is spying for you or against you. And I don't draw a moral equivalent between individuals who spy for countries that respect human dignity and human rights and democratic processes. They do not make a moral equivalent to those who spy for countries who degrade people, who essentially are prison states, who are dictatorships and those kinds of political systems. The point that I think that I would make, though, is that the spy, regardless of their motivation, is engaged in a second life that almost universally is high stress, high adrenaline, high excitement. And I think to respond to your initial question, that's one of the continuing attractions. I can say as an intelligence officer for the years that I worked, that's an exciting career. It's a fascinating career. It's a career that you wake up every morning and say, well, I may not make a difference today, but again, I've got a good chance. I've got a chance of doing so. And I think probably the spy has, in that sense, some of the same emotional, intellectual investment in doing the job as the case officer, as the intelligence officer has. So yeah, it's exciting business. No wonder it's portrayed excitingly.
All right. Well, it's something that's been with us across history. And for listeners out there who are considering getting into espionage, these are fair warnings about some of the issues that you'll be dealing with. Well, the book is Spy Sites of New York City, A Guide to the Region's Secret History. And listeners can learn a lot more about that if they check that book out. Bob and Keith, thanks for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so that is all for today. That's today's episode. Thank you for joining me. First off, I want to give a shout-out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, Tom from Ohio, Jennifer French Lee, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spy Master, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.